degree, to have an expert come up and help him.
We had about, about roughly 10% of our people were in development, research and development, and the rest of them were production.
Now, here we have the an article in the journal The Optical Society of America in 1941 on the...
I just want to carry myself, yeah. That was the first publication. That was in when?
41.
41, yeah, that would be about right. Yeah.
And it was, you wrote that in the spring of that year.
Yeah.
I wonder if you would, if you could just talk a little bit about the degree to which chemists were using spectrophotometers, visible spectra, as analytical tools at the time. And
Well, they were used to some extent, but not widely used, because at that time you had a matching field technique, you know, and that, and that's very tiring, and it's not very precise, and that's why this optical company was making these things. There's just no great market for them. They're not very popular instruments, and I realized that if we could, first of all, relieve the human fatigue, first of all, and second of all, get it to be an objective rather than a subjective determination, and also extend the optical range beyond the visual. These are the three things. Those are obvious to me at the time.
So you were doing, in this case, you were doing something very similar to what you did with the pH meter, which was to design the steel into the machine.
It's always been our thing. We build a complication into the machine to simplify. As I mentioned, the newest example is our Fourier transform infrared spectra. Did you ever see that?
No.
Well, you must come out and see that. That's a marvelous sensor. Not a single control knob on it. Mm-hmm. We standardized that. That's a single beam type of IO average, that's zero type of thing. We got things so stable now we can calibrate that at the factory and just run for weeks or months after that. It's got built into it lasers, it's got an interferometer built into the thing, and very, very complicated things inside, but for the user it's a simple thing to use.
When you were with the by 3940, were you drawing on other people at Caltech or elsewhere as consultants in the sort of development side of things? Or?
Yes, not so much at Caltech, because Caltech, as I say, was not an applied science group when they're... the only thing we got from Caltech was the Pauling oxygen analyzer, and that we were brought in because they found they couldn't make... I guess I told you that there. They found that making these things to predetermine specifications was quite different from just making a demonstration model or so. But that's about the only thing I recall we ever got from Caltech. We're indebted more to Rockefeller, as I mentioned there. You see, we got the ultracentrifuge from Dr. Pickels, who had been a Rockefeller developed. We got the Moorstein automated amino acid analyzer. And we got the peptide protein synthesizer from Bruce Merrifield. Three from Rockefeller.
Where does that Rockefeller connection trace back to?
Trace back to Dr. Pickels. He used to be at the University of Virginia working with Beams, you know, who had the air-driven quartz rotor ultrasound. And then the Rockefeller Institute, this before it was the university, and Irving Pickels was there. So he came out and teamed up with three other people from California, Morris Hanif in particular, who became president of the company, and two others, I forgot, the four of them formed a company called Specialized Instrument Company. And they developed the analytical ultracentrifuge, and then Morris Hanif came down to see me one day. He said, "Hey, we got a product, but we don't know how to go about selling it. How do you sell instruments?" So we got acquainted and talked to end up that we acquired specialized instrument core called Spinkle now. Yes. That's how we got into the ultracentrifuge. That was entirely through Dr. Pickels. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And what about other institutions? Did you, in fullness of time, did you have consultants back in Illinois, or is it really...
No, we've... not been so much consultants. We have had consultants, I'm sure. But mainly when we find somebody like Clark, Dr. Clark developed the Clark Collective. Well, we arranged to license his patent. And so it's mainly through that approach. Somebody would develop something, we'd hear of it, and then we'd move in. And
that sounds deceptively simple when you say someone would develop something and we would hear of it, and I'm sure it's true, but how many years of how did you do
well,
that? How did
you have to keep in mind that by now, you see, this is one of the advantages of selling directly. We have sales and service people, particularly service people. That's the thing we stress, because an instrument is no good if it isn't usable. And so we've spent a lot of our time and a lot of our money on building up a service organization. These people are in close touch with what's going on, and if a fellow develops something, well, our people know about it primarily. Once in a while, there'll be somebody that will come to us, know us from our other instruments, something like that, and wonder whether we're interested in his device. But by and large, our people in the field pick up the leads on it.
In a certain way, that's been true almost all along, because that was what Glenn Joseph was doing in a certain
yeah.
And that really has been a motif all the way through. Or did it pick up much more later on? Or?
Well, of course, there's been a constant change in our instruments. You see, from the days of the original pH meter and the spectrophotometer, the microchips have come in. So all of our instruments had to be redesigned, and we got a whole flow of new instruments. Now that's an in-house development. We have the techniques and we know what to do, and so that we don't. We depend on outside suppliers. Now we design our own chips, for example, but we have them made by others for us. We don't do that. But we have all that capability. We use CAD/CAM development, for example, and to
If we can get back to the consultants and funny out of it, this, how did you get in touch with Carey in developing the BU?
Oh, he came to work for us when I think when we were out on East Colorado Street, now Dr. Swift's dry cleaning place out there. He was one of the. We had several students from Caltech that came in later. George Shaw was one of them. He left us later on to work with Howard Hughes on developing the Spruce Goose. He developed on the resins and glues, isn't it? And a few others. Howard Carey was one that came out to work with us, and Henry Fracker was another. Matter of fact, Fracker spent a little time at Bell Labs too, and then he decided to go back to get his degree or do more graduate work at Caltech. And after a few months that, he gave it up, and he was sort of floating around, so he worked with us on some of these things, and that's he was co-patentee on that first patent. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And co-patentor. So students came in, or people came in from everywhere.
There was a very close tie between the early DU model and the pH meter, and that here's Bulletin 79 of National Technical Laboratories shows that you could use the pH meter.
Yeah. The first one, see, we had, you might ask why Model D. We had Model A, B, C. I don't know which one they're using in here. Do we have a model number on this? The first ones did plug into a pH meter to read the output of the photocell. And we made a few instruments. I don't think we sold them. I think we just put them out for evaluation. Yeah, I don't see any model number on here in my quick look over. I know one of them went to UCLA. Then we had another model before this in which we had a circular turret that would hold six cells per round, and we decided that was no good, so we abandoned that and went into this type of thing. By the time we got down to that model, it was Model D. That had a glass prism. Now, then we realized that if we wanted to work out in the ultraviolet, we had to use quartz. So we switched over to a quartz prism. That became the DU for ultraviolet.
And where did the first DUs go at this time?
Oh, UCLA got one of the early ones, and I don't know. I'd have to go over the user list and see just... There must be at least 25 or 30 people who claim they bought the first DU. We have 50 that claim they bought the first pH meter, I know.
But you have records in the company that would tell you this.
Possibly. Say, we do now. Mm-hmm. But back in those early days, record keeping was not one of our top priority things, and our records were a little bit sparse. Yeah. But some of these things we can find.
Well, here we have, in just just at the end of the war, an article in Instrumentation on spectrophotometric analysis.
Yeah.
Was this the sort of thing that you were trying to do to build up the business, or you just wanted to get the word out?
Oh, sure. This is trying to build up sales. Yeah. We wanted the world to know we had some instrumentation that would do us some good, and do us some good too if they bought the equipment. So this is just getting the story out. Mm-hmm. You have to keep in mind, back, and this is quite right after the war.
1945, summer of 1945.
The instrumentation techniques were not very sophisticated, and particularly in the industrial thing, they wouldn't go into. They had the big steam gauges and things like that. But we had a lot to learn too. I remember the first industrial instrument we went up. We had 256 screws in there. You know what they are? That's a small screw, you know. Well, you put them in with a jeweler screwdriver. That's fine for an instrument. When you got into a plant where the smallest screwdriver, perhaps a quarter of an inch. Well, we had to learn those things too on there. But
you had, by this time, by 1945, you had a sales and service force who were out.
No, we were depending on our dealers. Okay. Now we may for industrial thing. No. We were depending on our dealers, and maybe Herring or maybe one or two of our engineers would go around and talk to our dealers and mm-hmm. urge them to go into this field. But we didn't build up a sales force really until 1960.
Now we're just finishing up.
We'll be done in just a couple of minutes. I'd like to ask more questions about the DU and about the IR-1 and the connection with the synthetic rubber project in World War II, but those, I'm afraid, we'll have to wait for another time. It's been so interesting. We've gone on with some of the earlier ones. But just to finish up, I see here there are patents for a method of soil analysis for location of oil deposits in 1940.
Would I have a patent on that?
And proportioning in 1941. So it's clear that the early National Technical Laboratories was involved in a number of other ventures.
She had forgotten that he'd filed for patent application.
Do you recall what those arose from?
Oh, yes. This, I mentioned the National Postal Meter Company mm-hmm. that led tonight. Well, one of the owners, half-owners of that, was the Jurgens Oil Company. Uh-huh. And this is back when they were interested in geochemical prospecting. And McCormick and others were doing that. The idea was that over a dome of oil or gas, chances are the concentration of hydrocarbons in the soil above that would be higher than it would be in Barrington. So the question was to analyze the soil and plot a map on there and try to find out where they might do. The trouble that was that the methods for measuring hydrocarbon content or so were right on the borderline of what was possible and what was not possible, so that that never developed. This is before we had some of the new techniques available. We're doing it by straightforward chemical analysis, gas analysis mm-hmm. technique. So Jurgens always interested, so I got into that. In fact, we did discover one field for them up on San Marcos Pass. See, I'd forgotten we'd had a patent on that.
And the method of proportioning that was...
this is something else. This is stereometric. A fella came in the door one day out on East Colorado Street and wanted his help. At that time, there was a law in California, because you still have it, that when you wash dishes behind the counter, as you do in a bar or in a soda fountain, you had to have a sterilizing rinse. You had to have a three-tank rinse for washing and then a sterilizing and then a rinse. And you had to put in a sterilizing agent, which is usually hypochlorite. Well, that's nasty stuff to handle, you know, and the clerks wouldn't use it until they saw an inspector coming in the door. Then they'd really rush out and put the stuff in. So this fellow had developed a means for aspirating hypochlorite into the tank at the time you fill the tank. Mm-hmm. You just had an ordinary aspirator and a gallon bottle of hypochlorite to do it. But he realized that the sterilizing efficiency of the hypochlorite depends on the pH, how much hypochlorous acid is such and there, so that he knew we were in peace, but could we come in and devise a way of giving him pH control over this aspirator? That got us interested in the thing, and I realized that the aspirator is not a very precise proportioning device. So I developed then this, I guess that's what this is, the plastic has a cup on there. This was a precise way that, depending on how much water goes in, you actually displace the proper amount of disinfecting solution. So we got a patent on that. And we sold a lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
That was not our main business. He sold them, and we finally decided that selling this sort of thing was not consistent with selling precision scientific instruments, so we got out of it. One of the things that brought us that attention to show what happens is that we had a salesman in Long Beach selling a lot of these stereomatic things. Finally, we found out what he did. He'd go around, he had a centigrade thermometer. This is before centigrade temperature we talked about. He'd go in and switch this around. He said, that C stands for chlorine. Hey, you've got it. Your chlorine is clear off, something like that. As soon as we learned of that, say, we got to get out of this business. That's not consistent. But he was doing
so that. Here was an example of somebody coming to your door because they knew you were in pH,
that's
and it was sort of market response.
He wanted pH control on his product, yes.
And so it was another application of pH, which you talked about before as being an important aspect of the growth of the company early on, this dawning awareness of its importance.
As far as I know, this is still being sold by other companies. Mm-hmm. up in San Francisco, a fellow named Thompson still doing it, so that's sort of a useful purpose. Yeah.
But it was also consistent with the principles you were using to build what soon became Beckman Instruments, namely, we talked about some of the design principles you were using, but here was something where you wanted to just stick to the knitting, as it were, to stay in precision scientific instruments.
But it's the same sort of a thing. In other words, you wanted a precise chemical quantitative control. Yeah, I'd forgotten about these things. I'm pleased to talk because it provides memories on.
Did this sort of thing lead to, a little later on, to your decision to go into process control and industrial?
No, that came out as a natural development. See, we had pH meters, then we had a continuous recording pH meters, and then the continuous recording spectrophotometer. We had all the component parts. That was the way we got into process control.
And that gets us all the way back to the beginning, namely the Keystone Iron and Steel Works, where you were doing process control, but doing it the old-fashioned way. So I think there we'd better stop. And thank you very much, Dr. Beckman. It's been most interesting and enjoyable.
Thank you, Dr.
Well, I'm afraid I regaled you with a lot of stuff. So you've refreshed my memory on some. I've forgotten all about these patents in here, too.
Well, we have also, as long now that we're at it, here's something. Well, you saw that picture in the Rockefeller Symposium.
Yeah.
Who's the other person in it?
That's James D. McCullough. He died here just a couple of months ago. He was my graduate student at that time, and he was later on professor over at UCLA. In fact, they named the